It's the Garden Nerd Tip of the Week podcast, where we spend time chatting with expert gardening guests and we ask for their favorite tip. I'm Christy Wilhelmi. Thanks for joining me. Today's guest is Jessica Walliser, a horticulturist, garden columnist, and author of several books, including Good Bug, Bad Bug, and the award-winning Attracting Beneficial Bugs to the Garden. And her newest book is Gardener's Guide to Compact Plants, Edibles and Ornamentals for Small Space Gardening. Jessica also hosts the Organic Gardeners radio program on KDKA Radio in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and she happens to be the acquisitions editor for Cool Springs Press. And if that's not enough, she co-founded the popular gardening website, SavvyGardening.com. I'm so glad to have you here, Jessica.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm excited to join you.
Sure. Now, I was on your radio show a few years ago, but it was 4:30 in the morning, so I only remember talking to your co-host, Doug Oster, who conducted the interview. So I'm really glad we're getting a chance to chat at a decent hour today.
Well, I don't think any of our listeners who already get up early at 7 a.m. our time, I don't think any of them realized how early it was for you until Doug mentioned it at the end. Because you certainly didn't sound like it was 4:30 in the morning. You must have had your coffee early.
I think I was just sitting on the couch in the dark, hoping for the best. So you are on the East Coast. You're in Pennsylvania. Can you describe your homestead for our listeners?
Sure. Yeah. So we actually had a downsizing, let's say, of the homestead.
Okay.
About 10 years ago. We had an organic market farm for a number of years. And then when my son came along and my husband's commute got to be an hour and 15 minutes in each direction,
ugh,
we decided to literally give up the farm. And we moved to a 2-acre property. We're about 13 miles west of Pittsburgh, so we're very close to the Ohio border. But we have 2 acres. It's beautiful here. We're close to our neighbors, so our property is sort of narrow and long. So I have lots of room in the back for a fruit garden and a veggie garden and lots of perennial beds. And all kinds of good stuff. So, yeah, we have chickens. Well, we had chickens, I should say.
Uh-oh.
Unfortunately.
What happened?
I know. It's always a saga with the ladies.
But
we've had them, for 20-some-odd years off and on. And, gradually, one by one, they sort of get picked off by predators, even though we have them fenced in and the run is covered on the top. And somehow, we actually have a lot of minks where we live. So,
wow.
Yeah, so I think that's what got the most recent one. We had a chicken that was 11 years old.
Aw.
Yeah, and one day she just turned up missing. So we had one left.
Oh.
So we gave her to one of the neighbors who has 30 chickens, and she fit right in. So, yeah.
Oh, well, that's...
So for the first time in many years, we have no chickens.
Oh, well, you said you downsized to 2 acres, and I want to upsize to 2 acres. I feel like 2 acres is the perfect size for a homestead. Do you find that to be more manageable?
Yeah, it is, for sure. I mean, especially going from 20-plus acres down to this, it's definitely more manageable. We have a little more lawn than I would like.
Uh-huh.
We do have the back portion of it is wooded, but we have... more grass than I would like to have. So the eventual goal is to get rid of a good bit of the grass and put in sort of like a wildflower meadow planting with Pennsylvania native plants. But of course, that takes money and time.
Right.
And so we're working on collecting enough of both to make that project come to fruition.
Right.
It's going to be cool when it happens.
And you mentioned that you have a lot more lawn than you'd like. Now, here in Southern California, we are trying to encourage people to take out their lawns, but that's because we don't get rain. How many inches of rain do you average per year?
I have no idea, but I can tell you that the last few years, all through the spring and early summer, we have been up by several inches.
Okay.
We have just had steady rainfall. The grass actually never shifted into a dormancy this year. Usually it gets brown in the summer. We don't irrigate. We don't fertilize. We don't do weed control. It just sort of is sort of our quilted patch, right?
Mm-hmm.
We call it our quilted lawn. And so we don't put any effort into it other than mowing every 2 weeks, and that's really it. So it never went dormant. So we had enough rainfall the last couple of years for that to happen. So we're kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum here.
Right. And that's, you said you don't use any fertilizers, or you just kind of let it go. You don't weed. And I imagine that's because you're known in certain circles as the bug lady, and you've written at least two books on that subject. So I'm imagining your lawn sort of feeds the beneficial insects in your area.
It definitely does. I mean, we have a lot of clover in our lawn. In the spring, we have a lot of creeping Charlie. Both of those are, plants that pollinators really like. Not necessarily native pollinators, though. So, like the honeybees are the ones that really like the clover, although there are a few native bee species that go for the clover. But, we're careful when we mow because we have all those flowering plants in the lawn and a lot of certainly violets in the lawn as well. So we typically try to really mow early in the morning or late in the evening so that we are not, harming any pollinators because they don't know to get out of the way of the mower. Mm-hmm. So you really want to watch your timing of that mowing. And like I said, we really only mow every 2 weeks, sometimes less frequently than that if there's nothing going on. Where we live, we can let it get kind of long and not have to worry too much about it.
Nice.
But the goal is to, put in more wildflowers that don't have to be mowed at all and, get more of that lawn converted into garden space.
Right. So that brings me to my next question, which is, what are some of your favorite beneficial insects and how do you like to attract them to your garden?
Oh my gosh, that's a loaded question.
I know, it's huge.
It's like picking your favorite kid or whatever,
So, we can take it in parts.
There you go. So I guess first, I think it would probably be really good for me to separate the two major groups of beneficial insects, right? So although every insect has a role in the ecosystem, so really when you think about it and from that point of view, all of them are beneficial, except maybe the ones that are imported here and have become invasive. Those
right.
don't count, right? But everybody else has a role in the ecosystem, right? So, but from a gardener's point of view, we're talking about insects being beneficial in one of two ways. The first is that they're a pollinator, mm-hmm. right? So we know we have 4,000 species of native bees in North America. We have 750 species of butterflies. We certainly know there's lots of beetles and wasps and flies that serve to pollinate as well. Mm-hmm. And then the other group of beneficials, which is really what my focus is, although I love the pollinators, but mine is really on the beneficial predatory insects.
Yes.
These are the bugs that do your dirty work.
Yes.
They're the ones that help you control the pests. And if you create a garden and a space where they can really thrive, you will be relying on pesticides and physical traps and mechanical controls for pests a whole lot less often because you have like your own little built-in army working for you.
Right.
So that's what the focus of my books are on, that group of beneficial insects.
And those, I think, are the ones that I would like to focus on today because those are my favorite as well.
Good. Kindred spirits.
Yes.
Yes.
Like my favorite is the parasitic wasp because it pokes holes in aphids and lays its young inside it. The best.
Right?
So what are some of your favorites?
That's only one group of parasitic wasps. The ones that, aphidious wasps, which use the aphids, as hosts for their young.
Uh-huh.
But there are thousands of other species of parasitic wasps that use different species of insects to house and feed their developing young. So a lot of people are familiar with the tomato or tobacco hornworm,
mm-hmm.
and how the Cotesia wasp lays 100 to 300 eggs in the back, just under the skin of that caterpillar. And then the larval wasp spends its entire larval life stage inside the body of that hornworm. And then when it's ready to pupate, it kind of oozes out through the skin of the caterpillar and spins an external cocoon. And that's what we see sometimes, those little white, like little grains of rice hanging off the back of those caterpillars.
Right.
That's the wasp that is pupating into an adult and then will go off to fly and do it all over again. So I love the parasitic wasps as well. There's a bunch that do, true bugs. Many of them actually are quite specialist, which is really interesting. It's like one species of wasp can only use one species of caterpillar to house and rear its developing young. So they've co-evolved together, and maybe that caterpillar only feeds on one or two species of plants. So we have this three-way partnership, right, between the plant, the what we perceive as a pest, which is really just a caterpillar, and then the parasitoid. And then there's other layers of it as well, because sometimes parasitic wasps have other insects that parasitize them. So So it's kind of all this big connected web, and that's what's so cool for me about beneficial insects is how they're tied to everything else in the ecosystem of the garden. It's really fascinating.
I agree. And so what are some of your favorite plants to plant or ways to attract these great bugs, these predator bugs to your garden?
Well, I would say probably the best way, number one, is to stop using pesticides.
Ding.
We oftentimes will spray a pesticide. Let's use the example of spider mites, right?
Right.
So we have spider mites on our phlox or our spruce plants, and we reach for the spray can and we spray some. Sometimes it's a chemical, and sometimes it's something like horticultural oil, which is safe to use in organic gardening, but it also kills many species of beneficial parasitic mites that will eat the bad mites. So you're kind of blanket applying a product that many times will also knock down the population of beneficials. And just by the way the predator and prey cycle works, those mites have a faster reproduction cycle, just like a rabbit who's also a prey for a coyote. They have a faster reproductive cycle. They have more babies per birth, right? They live a life that they can reproduce at a really young age, and their reproduction cycle is quick. So their population rebounds so much faster than the predatory mite species or the beneficial insect species do. Or if you're talking about the rabbits, we're talking about the coyotes, right? They don't reproduce as fast as the rabbits. So what ends up happening is you get into this vicious cycle. So number one, stop using the pesticides and give the good bugs time to do their jobs.
Right.
To do what they've evolved to do.
Even organic, really.
Even organic. I mean, I have not sprayed, even having our farm, not sprayed anything, organic or otherwise, in 22 years.
Right.
So you can have a beautiful garden without all of that input being put in your garden. So
yes.
Number one is that. Number two is plant a diverse habitat. You know, not everybody has the same shape mouth in the insect world. All we humans have the same shape mouth. We have the same morphology, right? Insects do not. A ladybug mouth is different than a parasitic wasp mouth, which is different than a lacewing mouth, which is different than, you know, any other beneficial insect has a different mouth part. And because of that, for those species that rely at one point in their life cycle on pollen and nectar, they have to have a diversity of flower shapes to drink pollen and eat nectar from. So the greater diversity of plant species you can have in your landscape, from the size, from the structure of the plant, from the bloom time to the bloom shape to the size of the flower, the more diversity you can have, the better. Some plants are better than others for supporting beneficial insects, but the goal is to have as much diversity as possible.
And do you have any favorites that you like to plant in your own garden?
Well, I would say for the parasitic wasps, for ladybugs, for lacewings, for the big-eyed bugs, which do drink pollen and nectar early in the spring when there's not a lot of, protein-based prey available for them. Mm-hmm. You know, those types of insects really love to have flowers with a shallow, exposed nectary because they don't have a long tongue or a deep proboscis like a butterfly would have. So they can't drink nectar from a tubular flower. Mm-hmm. So they want tiny flowers that are shallow and exposed nectaries. And number one plant family for that is the carrot family.
Right.
APACA.
The umbel family. So, yeah.
Yes. Yep. Umbel family. So the blooms, think of a dill flower or a Queen Anne's lace flower, right? It looks like an umbrella. It's got not one flower, but it's got thousands of tiny flowers clustered together in that inflorescence. And those types of flowers are perfect for these little beneficial insects.
Great. And so a lot of people pull their plants too early, and if they just get lazy and leave them and let them go to seed, they'll get those umbel flowers.
Exactly. Sometimes a little too many, right? Because they produce so darn many seeds.
Yes.
And they come up quite prolifically. But there's some really amazing native members of that plant family too, like the angelicas.
Mm, yes.
So, you know, and it's okay if they reseed everywhere because they're native and they can do that, right? So you do want to be careful when you're thinking about introducing some of these plants to the garden, especially if you want to, you know, include as many native plants as possible. I would urge your listeners to sort of do a little research and find some species that are local to their region, and that's the one they should go crazy with.
Right. I refer people often to the Theodore Payne Foundation. That's our native plant nursery out here in Los Angeles, and they They carry plants for all the 1,000 native species of California bees. So that is that's an important thing. Pollen and nectar match up with the native species.
Absolutely. And, you know, that I think is something a lot of people don't realize. They're always, you know, have honeybees on their mind, and they forget about all of these other important native pollinators and beneficials who rely on that nectar.
Right. So let's jump to your new book, Gardener's Guide to Compact Plants. As a small space gardener, I found this book very interesting. It offers concrete advice for small space gardeners, including 10 garden plans from guest designers, friends of yours, I'm assuming, and a slew of specific plant cultivars that people can try. Can you give us an example of the plants you highlight in the book?
Sure. So I know a lot of your listeners are vegetable gardeners.
Yes.
And this was one of my favorite sections to write in this book, although I do have compact perennials, compact trees, compact shrubs. The last section in the book is dedicated to compact vegetables. And these are things that do beautifully in an urban environment. Whether you're growing in just one little tiny raised bed or all you have are patio planters, these varieties are bred to stay small in stature and produce prolific yields, but just in a much smaller package. So, like, for example, patio snacker cucumber, which I grow in my big vegetable garden simply because it's such a great prolific plant, but it's really bred for container culture because the vines don't get real long and crazy. You can just kind of grow it up a trellis in a pot and have this great harvest of cucumbers in a container, which is amazing.
Nice. And I'm not seeing, I have your book right in front of me, by the way. I'm wondering if you can share the source of these seeds when, if you know them off the top of your head.
Yeah, so a lot of these are actually available. So there's a resource section in the back of the book, which lists some of my favorite companies and seed catalogs. Now, it doesn't sort them by which variety is in which place, right? Because what happens is if they stop carrying it, then I hear from people.
Right.
So I just sort of gave, like, you know, you're going to have to maybe approach a couple of these seed companies till you find it. But all the varieties in here, especially the vegetables, are available from multiple seed sources. So you do have to do a little bit of research for it. But these are not, like, secret hidden varieties. Like, these are ones that a lot of different seed companies, especially if you start from seed, they have them. You know, you might have a hard time going to your favorite local nursery and saying, hey, I want a starter plant of fairy tale eggplant, because they might only grow two or three varieties of eggplant.
Right.
If you start to ask for these more compact varieties, what I've found in our nurseries is they're likely to grow them the next year if they hear good things about them and enough people ask.
Yeah, and I know that for stores, nurseries that carry Renee's Garden Seeds, which is a California-based seed company, it's actually one of the only, I think it is the only California-based seed company, she breeds a lot of varieties specifically for containers, so those are options. But I love that you've got designs in your book that are specifically for small spaces, and let's talk a little bit about the designs that you have from your guest designers. There were the Tex-Mex garden, which actually would work for our zone, because it's got some plants that work in zone 10, and the mini herb garden and the kitchen garden. Those three designs specifically work very well in Southern California zone. So let's chat about those a little bit.
Yeah, so the plants, I mean, I was lucky enough to have 10 folks that I approached. I approached 10 and all 10 of them said yes, which was incredible to me. I wanted to get designers from around the country that would really represent sort of different styles, a different plant palette, but yet all using compact varieties in really small spaces. So they all came through with shining colors, and then of course the publisher had an illustrator to create all the designs. But I love, you know, the kitchen garden design in here is Ellen Ecker Ogden, who's sort of the goddess of kitchen gardens, and it's really a classic potager style. You know, very symmetrical, and it's just beautiful, and it would really work lovely. And you could change the size of those beds. You could make them 4x4 or 6x6 or 8x8, right?
Right.
Depending on how much space that you have. And the herb one. I mean, everybody loves herbs. Everybody grows herbs. You know, it's sort of like a gateway to vegetable gardening for so many people.
Right.
And this design is just 6x6. So it's not a big space, but yet you're growing a dozen different types of herbs in that little 6x6 space.
And that's Nikki Jabor's design, right?
Yep, that's Nikki Jabor, who's one of my partners at SavvyGardening.com.
Right.
She's definitely an edibles expert for sure, so she knows her herbs very well.
Yes, and we had her on the podcast not too long ago, so she was talking about her new book, which both of you are such prolific writers. It's so great having you.
It's great, but I don't know if that makes us crazy or what. But we do. We tend to do it in cycles, and our cycles seem to be synced with book writing. We always seem to be working on a book at the same time, so it's good to have somebody to bounce ideas off of them.
Right. And so the Tex-Mex garden is more, it's not an edible garden, it's kind of it would work in desert communities or some semi-subtropical type of areas, right?
Yeah, it's really a patio garden for a dry climate. And I asked Jenny Peterson, who's a garden designer in, I believe it's Austin, Texas, to do this. And these were plants that here in Pennsylvania, I'm not very familiar with. You know, we can't grow many of the plants that she talked about and used in this plan. But yet she almost gives you basically a design for your new patio, right?
Right.
It's surrounded by a wall and plantings of these amazing short statured compact plants. And she did a great job with it too.
Right. And it's funny because I actually recognize the plants in that plan because there's things like, Asclepias tuberosa, which is milkweed. And I'm just looking here. Mexican bush sage, salvia, leucantha. Those kinds of things that work well in my climate and are pretty much ubiquitous everywhere we are. Whereas, you know, a lot of your other designs have things like peonies, which we can't grow here, and lots of evergreen, you know, ferns and things like that that we can't grow.
Yeah, and that's, again, why I tried to get a range of designers in here that had a range of plant palettes.
Yeah.
And it's also easy, you know, one of the things that I mentioned near in the intro to the design chapter, you know, you can take these plans and swap out other plants. So if there's something in that plan, let's say you're looking at the patio garden and, you know, this was designed by someone from New York State, and you're thinking, well, that plant's never going to, you know, thrive where I am, you can go to the back of the book and look at some other compact shrubs that would thrive where you are and swap those out in the design. Everything has dimensions in here, which I think is really important. The mature dimensions, when you introduce a plant to your landscape, you always have to think about what's it going to look like? How big is it going to be when it's mature? Sometimes we go to the nursery and something's nice and tiny and compact in a pot, but then it gets to be 10 feet tall. So the nice thing about the varieties that I feature in the book is none of them are going to get that big unless it's in the tree section.
Right.
Because I do, you know, that is small for a tree. And so I do talk about that difference as well. But it's easy to sub out the plants.
That's a great resource. Now, early in your book, you write about the correct way to plant a shrub or a tree, specifically about root loosening. Can you describe that method so people can get it right?
Yeah, this is a process that is surprisingly important. And especially new gardeners, they're really afraid to disturb a plant's roots because they think that that means it's going to kill the plant, right? They don't want to be too rough on it.
Right.
But any tree or shrub or perennial or even an annual or vegetable, when you take it out of its pot and the roots are circling around in the pot where they're really dense and thick and fibrous in there, you have to loosen them up to spread them out into the planting hole. Because if you just take it out of the pot, plunk it right in the hole, basically those roots are going to circle around in that potting soil, and they're going to continue to stay in that shape, and they're not going to reach out into the native soil, which makes them, you know, really prone to drought conditions. It makes them less able to access nutrients, and it really just plain stresses them out. Sometimes they can actually girdle themselves,
right?
Like circling around and around. So getting in there, take the pot off of the plant, get in there. Sometimes you can do it with your fingertips. Sometimes you need a pair of pruners to cut through the roots. Sometimes you need a saw to cut away the outer edge of the roots. The deal is you can't be gentle in this process. You have to really get aggressive with it and really loosen up those roots so they spread out into the hole. So I even know some people that use a pressure washer when they're planting a tree or shrub that was in a pot and it was very pot-bound. They'll use it on the lowest setting, and they just basically wash all of the soil off of the roots of that plant, and then they can untangle the roots and spread them out into the hole. And that, you know, allows that plant to get quicker access to the nutrients and the water and really spread out into the native soil faster. So there's actually a good bit of research that they're doing right now to look at whether this is actually the best planting method. They don't know whether or not it is because they need to do some long-term studies on it, but it certainly works for plants that are very, very root-bound.
That's fascinating because I know I certainly, as a garden consultant, when I show people how to plant, they freak out at ripping apart the root ball. And, you know, I assure them it's going to be okay. Even the plants that don't like their roots disturbed, like cucumbers and melons and squash, you still have to get them out of the pattern of circling in that pot. So it's nice to know that you can be even more aggressive with the jet blast, in some cases.
Yeah, and that's really primarily trees and shrubs where you would want to do that.
Right.
And that's for something like, let's say there's been a plant that has sat at your local nursery all summer long, and they're watering it, they're taking good care of it, but when it's in a pot that long, the roots are definitely going to circle, and it's really going to be pot-bound, and that makes it so much harder to establish that tree or shrub. Mm-hmm. So just this extra step of giving it a jump, you know, a heads up, a jump start, and then making sure that it's well-watered through that first season, that's really going to do, it's just going to help your plant take off and really be successful.
Great. And that's a fantastic tip, but it is tip time, so I'm going to grill you for another one. Do you have a favorite tip that you'd like to share with the Garden Nerd audience?
Oh my gosh, I have a billion. Let's go back to the beneficial bugs.
Yes.
Tip, if we could,
okay.
Right? So you were asking me what things we can do in the garden to really promote beneficial insects, and I'd like to mention one more.
Okay.
And that is how to treat your garden in the fall. You know, traditionally we're taught to cut everything down, rake everything up, put your garden to bed clean and pristine, when actually that's exactly the opposite of what pollinators and beneficial insects need. They need you to leave your garden be messy. Like, stop treating it like your living room, because it's not your living room. They need to have cover for the winter. They need to have hollow stems to hunker down in. They need to have debris and leaves sitting there for them to take shelter in for the winter. So stop doing a fall cleanup. Wait to clean up your garden until the following spring, ideally when the temperatures have been in the 50s for at least a week. That's when it's your signal to go ahead and do your cleanup.
That's a great tip. And I have an anecdote about that myself. When growing asparagus, there's controversy over whether to prune back the foliage in the fall or in the spring. And I leave my asparagus foliage over winter because my ladybug population mates in the asparagus foliage. And so we've got tons of ladybug larvae. You know, they look like alligators with college sweaters on, and they're hanging out in that foliage all winter long here because we don't get snow, so that's where things are actually kind of happy here in our garden. And then I cut the foliage down in spring, and the new asparagus starts to jump up. So I think that's a great tip.
Yeah, and they're probably, those ladybug larvae are probably really helping you with the asparagus beetle larvae.
Yeah.
I think you have those in California. I think they're coast to coast, asparagus beetles, but they're going to help you get a jump start on things in the spring. And if you clean everything up in the fall, they're not going to be there in the spring anymore.
That's a great tip. Well, thank you so much for sharing that tip, Jessica. And thanks for being a guest on the Garden Nerd Tip of the Week podcast.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Sure. How do people find you?
They can find me at my website, which is either savvygardening.com, S-A-V-V-Y, savvygardening.com, or my personal website, which is jessicawalliser.com.
Excellent. And do you have any social media feeds that you'd like to share as well?
I have them all. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, on Pinterest, or Savvy Gardening on Pinterest, and obviously LinkedIn. We have a YouTube channel as well, so you can pretty much find me anywhere.
Great. All right, garden nerds, you'll find links to Jessica's website and savvygardening.com on gardennerd.com this week. We'll also post links to Jessica's social media feeds and, of course, her books. That's it for this week. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Visit us for tons of free gardening information at gardennerd.com. Show your support for this podcast and the other free stuff on Garden Nerd by becoming a Patreon subscriber. And you'll find us on Instagram and Twitter under Garden Nerd One, on Facebook as gardennerd.com, and of course, our Garden Nerd YouTube channel. Happy gardening!